Thanks for joining us. I'm Frank Sesno, host of Planet Forward and director of the School of Media and Public Affairs at the George Washington University, sitting in for Diane Rehm today. She's visiting Interlochen Public Radio in Traverse City, Michigan. She'll be back with you tomorrow. Well, acclaimed author Ian McEwan has said the best way to tell people about climate change is through nonfiction. His latest novel attempts to do just that in a blend of science, fiction, comedy, and very interesting characters. It's titled Solar, and the best-selling author of Atonement. And it joins me now in the studio to talk about it. And welcome to you. Thanks for coming in. This is an interesting book.
Well,
this is a different kind of book. Tell us about your premise going into it.
Well, I think the novel is not easily adapted to the whole issue of climate change. The whole subject is impregnated with morals, ethics, politics, statistics, hard science, and the last thing a novel wants to do is to tell people how to think. So I think here we're looking at a fiction that reflects the problem or reflects our nature running up against a rather unique, historically unprecedented problem. So I've really let this become a character-led kind of novel. A character who's full of many, many faults that we all have in some small part, especially around the area of consumption.
He consumes so much he himself physically gets bigger as the novel progresses.
He starts the novel out with sort of 20, 30 pounds overweight. He ends up 65 pounds overweight. He cannot resist junk food. He also likes the higher things of life, like business class food too. He makes resolutions all along the way, just as we have politically in climate change, have made stirring resolutions back at the Rio conference in the early 90s. But public administration being what it is and human nature being what it is, we find it very difficult. There's a shadow that falls between the resolution and the act.
Ian McEwan, are you saying that we're like Michael Beard, that we just consume more and more? We make resolutions and we defy them. We add weight and chins.
Yes.
And we ignore them.
Anyone over 50 regularly tells themselves after Christmas, I have to do something about myself, and then a few days go by or weeks and nothing happens. So he's a sort of comic victim in a way of his own appetites and nature. But he's also got, he inherits another side of human nature. He is monstrously clever. He has a Nobel Prize in physics. And I think this is really, as I see it anyway, one of the great problems. And it was brought together for us in microcosm at Copenhagen, the big climate change conference last year. Rationality, science had brought 190-odd nations in one place to debate a serious matter. And what got in the way? Some other aspect. There's science, there's our cleverness, our rationality, another side of our nature, our tribalism, national self-interest, cabals, jealousies, greed. The whole thing falls apart. Now, Michael Beard actually does get invited to go to Copenhagen at the end of this novel, and my feeling is that he very much embodies its spirit.
Meaning?
That farcical level that we saw enacted there, when it was a huge disappointment to anyone who carried hopes for this conference.
So you feel that as your character is a farcical character, an over-consuming character who speaks about rationality but breaks that bond at almost every turn,
yes.
And we'll talk about some of that in just a minute, so are we collectively, you feel, similarly engaged in this discussion in a farcical way with climate change?
Well, I think we're racked in this. We have such tools of analysis for our dilemmas.
We call it science, I think.
Yes, and we can discuss these things seriously and responsibly, but in fact we find it very hard to do anything about it. You know, you and I will talk about this and then we'll get in our cars and we'll get on our airplanes and we'll, you know, eat a jolly good meal and maybe a great chunk of meat that is obviously very inefficient to produce but delicious to consume and hard to turn aside from. We're not programmed to think in the long term. We're asked here, in this matter, to do favors for people we'll never meet, our great-grandchildren. We're biologically adapted, I think, to eat when things are put in front of us.
Since this is a character-engaged novel, let's spend a moment, just a moment, introducing our listeners to Michael Beard, who I must say is a challenge to fall in love with, and yet you have a number of women who seem to do just that.
Yes, he's one of those surprising men, and you must have run into them, who doesn't look great. He's rather fat and not particularly prepossessing, doesn't have much of his hair left. But he seems to attract a certain kind of beautiful woman, not least because he thinks he's attractive. That gives him a sort of swaggering confidence. He's also a high-status guy. He's got a Nobel Prize. He's sort of famous in a limited field. He's something of a liar, a cheat, a philanderer, and a plagiarizer, crucially, of another scientist, a young scientist's work. In other words, I would say he belongs in the tradition, fictionally, of a scoundrel. And the scoundrel, the original large scoundrel in literature who casts a very long and wide shadow is Shakespeare's Falstaff. If you met Falstaff, you would probably be repelled, but you are happy to travel with him in a way. There's another scoundrel, a lesser scoundrel, I suppose, but still a man of dubious morals and limited education in recent literature. And he is John Updike's rabbit. An amazing trick that John Updike pulled with...
Which you invoke rabbit. in the opening pages of this book.
Yes, Rabbit is full of good lines. I could have quoted many more. But what's so brilliant about the rabbit novels of Updike is that he makes us travel for a very long time with a man who, you know, who sleeps with his son's wife at one point, there's one low moment. And yet Updike has managed to filter 40 years of American social change as well as all the chaos of a crowded private life. So there are examples of men who and women who are not particularly wonderful morally that we are obliged to share some time with.
Well, you oblige us to share some time with Michael Beard. To the Updike epigraph in your book, you write, "It gives him great pleasure," quoting from Rabbit is Rich, "it gives him great pleasure, makes Rabbit feel rich, to contemplate the world's wasting, to know the earth is mortal too." Why?
We identify, I think, sometimes our lives with the earth we live on. You notice over many hundreds of years of history, there'll rise up movements, millennial movements, that will tell you that the earth is coming to an end. They swept across Europe in the Middle Ages, right through to the 15th century. And I think there's a strong identification that we're going to die and we feel the earth must die too. And I think that is the engine of a great deal of cultural pessimism. So that's why I think many people are skeptical about climate change, because I think it's one more millennial warning. You know, they told us 30 years ago that we're going to all die in a nuclear exchange, or they told us that the world was coming to an end because Christ is risen again and has come to take only the saved home. The Nazis had their own 1,000-year millennial project. Soviet communism had its same kind of instinct for endings.
You explore this, Ian McEwan, in the early pages of this book, where you introduce us to Beard, Michael Beard, as we're learning, getting to know him, and to his connection to the issue of climate change. And I'm wondering if you go to page 15, we're sharing a book here across the table, if you'd read this passage that we discussed, because it's quite interesting as you set up Michael Beard and his attitude toward climate change.
Page 15?
Page 15.
Okay.
Starts that last paragraph right at the end.
Beard was not wholly skeptical about climate change. It was one in a list of issues of looming sorrows that made up the background to the news, and he read about it, vaguely deplored it, and expected governments to meet and take action. And, of course, that he knew that a molecule of carbon dioxide absorbed energy in the infrared range and that humankind was putting these molecules into the atmosphere in significant quantities. But he himself had other things to think about. And he was unimpressed by some of the wild commentary that suggested the world was in peril, that humankind was drifting towards calamity, when coastal cities would disappear under waves, crops fail, and hundreds of millions of refugees surge from one country, one continent to another, driven by drought, floods, famine, tempests, unceasing wars for diminishing resources. There was an Old Testament ring to the forewarnings, an air of plague of boils and deluge of frogs that suggested a deep and constant inclination enacted over the centuries to believe that one was always living at the end of days, that one's own demise was urgently bound up with the end of the world and therefore made more sense or was just a little less irrelevant. The end of the world was never pitched in the present, where it could be seen for the fantasy it was, but just around the corner. And when it did not happen, a new issue, a new date would soon emerge. The old world purified by incendiary violence, washed clean by the blood of the unsaved. That was how it had been for the Christian millennialist sects. Death to the unbelievers. And for Soviet communists, death to the kulaks. And for Nazis and their thousand-year fantasy, death to the Jews. And then the truly democratic contemporary equivalent, an all-out nuclear war, death to everyone. When that did not happen, and after the Soviet Empire had been devoured by its internal contradictions, and in the absence of any other overwhelming concern beyond boring, intransigent global poverty, the apocalyptic tendency had conjured yet another beast.
I hear Michael Beard, but I hear the broader debate.
Yes. I mean, when you cast these men as villains in this piece, you always want to give them a little bit more space. You know, there's another voice behind them.
We'll talk about those voices and the villains, and we'll talk about how Ian McEwan came to write about climate change as his backdrop when the Diane Rehm Show continues. Welcome back to the Diane Rehm Show. I'm Frank Sesno, sitting in for Diane Rehm today, who's in Traverse City, Michigan, and she will be back tomorrow. And my apologies to the residents and to her gracious hosts in Traverse City. It's a place I haven't had the opportunity or the privilege to visit yet or pronounce right, so now I hope I've done that. And again, my apologies to you, and I hope you are enjoying Diane's visit. We are speaking with Ian McEwan, author of Solar, his new book, Solar, certainly author of Atonement, you know him from that, and many other of his award-winning works. And we were discussing before the break this backdrop of climate change and your characters, your sort of unsavory scoundrel here, Michael Beard's ambivalent attitude toward this sort of sensory overload one senses from him, both in terms of how he perceives the world and how he absorbs it. And your sense that this is, in fact, representative of the larger debate and what you earlier called the farce in Copenhagen.
Yes. I mean, he has to carry some weight here. I mean, not just the weight he puts on around his waist. And he makes a journey from being something of a doubter, a skeptic, a man who believes that the whole climate change debate has been sort of racked up too high. But fortune or misfortune places within his hands a technology, artificial photosynthesis, which he decides to make his own, takes the patents out on it, or even though it belongs to another man, and sets out to save the world.
So our scoundrel essentially steals the technology, steals the idea from somebody else, and then goes off to save the world.
Yes, and then adapts his views accordingly.
So I don't know whether to root for him or to hate him.
You will just have to travel with him and sense that in some ways he does carry with him some parallels of our own problem here. As I said earlier, the cleverness running up against the greed. If, as I hope will happen, we do have our industrial revolution that will bring us clean technology, it's going to be a gold rush. I mean, all kinds of unsavory types are going to rush in because there'll be money to be made. If you've got to re-energize the world, the civilization that we live in, as well as continue to lift people out of poverty the way that burning fossil fuels has done for a couple of centuries, you're going to have all kinds of people. It'll be like the Wild West. There'll be frontier towns, as it were, of the mind, in which people will be trading in carbon credits. Already I was invited on an internet site to put money into a scheme to dump iron filings in the oceans just to the north of the Galapagos Islands to encourage plankton growth and sell the offset to coal mining companies.
Did you do it?
Of course not. And I saw it got closed down, but it interested me that already there was a bit of scam going on there.
We're speaking with Ian McEwan, author of Atonement and much else, his new book, Solar, and you can put your question to the author by calling us at 1-800-433-8850. We'll take your calls in a few minutes. Or you can send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. Ian McEwan, where did the idea come from? At what moment did you say, I must write about this topic somehow in fictional form?
I started thinking about it way back in the mid-90s, but I couldn't see a way in, really. And I wrote other novels and kept my interest up in the matter. But really it came with a trip to the Arctic, which we can talk about.
No, I'm just asking you. There we go. It came about from your trip to the Arctic. Talk about that.
Yeah, I spent some time in the Arctic, a week in the Norwegian Arctic with a group of artists. And we were in a ship frozen into a fjord. Mm. And we had some very passionate debates about climate change in the evenings. And what I noticed, and actually the others noticed it too, was that the kit room, the boot room, where we slipped in and out of all this very heavyweight gear to go out into minus 45 degrees, this room was becoming more and more chaotic. And so the discrepancy between the huge boot room of the Earth, as it were, that we were wanting to organize over our glasses of wine in the evening, and this tiny little space which was falling into chaos around our feet, that gave me the first hint that maybe there was a vein of humor that I could touch in this problem that we have.
So you take Michael Beard to the Arctic. Your character goes, yes, on the same trip you were. Apparently this is the trip that prompted you to move in this direction. And to say he has an unusual experience, I believe, would be an understatement.
Yes. Well, just like I did, he took some freezing cold snowmobile rides. And it crossed my mind that if a fellow wanted to do what Mark Twain called confer with himself, obey the call of nature in the situations we found ourselves, very strong winds, unbelievably cold, little white spots of frostbite beginning to appear on the tips of people's noses, that you would take your life, as it were, literally into your hands. So I thought, well, why not explore this in fiction?
We'll leave it at that.
Yes. This is a family show, I'm sure.
But the interesting thing is this boot room. You talk about the boot room. So here you've got your scoundrel of a character going to Antarctica to explore what the implications of climate change with all these do-gooder environmentalists, and they keep stealing, or this gear keeps disappearing out of this room. I mean, so are these wonderfully adventurous and altruistic people, or are they thieves?
Not quite. I mean, the gear is all, it belongs to no one. It's all been issued to them, as it was to us. And what happens is it's a dark and cramped space, and a helmet goes missing into the darkness of the corner of the room, and so someone reaches for another helmet, and then the true owner comes along and he takes someone else's. It's a sort of organizational entropy that descends on the place. I don't really want to make out that we were all thieves. But I did find myself out on the ice with two left boots on one occasion. And, you know, we all suffered from this sense of how hard it was to keep this organized. So it was just a little beginning for me. It was really a hint.
You are known for your prose and for the great detail and richness that you weave into it. And you have a scene, which I'd like to ask you to read, where Michael Beard is flying into London. And as he flies in, what he sees and how you have him observe what he is seeing becomes your tapestry, really, for the planet and for what we're facing. So I'm wondering if I could ask you to take a look at that for us and share that with us.
So he's turning in the stack above Heathrow. He's about sort of 3,000 or 4,000 meters up, and he's looking down. Whichever direction his gaze fell, this was home, his native corner of the planet. The fields and hedgerows, once tended by medieval peasants and 18th-century labourers, still visibly patterned the land in irregular quadrilaterals. And every brook, fence and pigsty, virtually every tree, was known and probably named in the Doomsday Book after all-conquering William in 1085 conferred with his advisers and sent his men all over England. And ever since, named again with greater refinement, owned, used, costed, traded, mortgaged, mature like a thick-crusted Stilton, as richly stuffed with varied humanity as Babel, as historical as the Nile Delta, teeming like a charnel house with ghosts, in public discourse as dissonant as a rookery in full throat. One day, this brash and ancient kingdom might yield to the force of multiple cravings, to the dreamy temptations of a giant metropolis, a Mexico City, Sao Paulo and Los Angeles combined, to effloresce from London to the Medway, to Southampton to Oxford, back to London, a modern form of quadrilateral, burying all previous hedges and trees. Who knew? Perhaps it would be a triumph of racial harmony and brilliant buildings, a world city, the most admired world city in the world. How, wondered Beard, as his plane at last quit the stack on a banking hairpin tangent and lined itself up north of the Thames to begin its descent. How could we ever begin to restrain ourselves? We appeared at this height like a spreading lichen, a ravaging bloom of algae, a mould enveloping a soft fruit. We were such a wild success, up there with the spores.
A rather bleak view.
Well, I disagree. I think the thing is, when you look at a great city from the air, you think, what a brilliant achievement it is. How can we resist it? How can we resist growing?
A ravaging bloom of algae?
Well, from the distance, a spore that ruins, you know, the fruit and the bowl if you leave it too long, is still a thing of beauty. I mean, it renders that apple inedible, that orange. And the thing is that we have made a civilization that has many aspects of this, both irresistible and fabulous, and yet we have to somehow restrain ourselves. Almost any organization, a university, a media outfit, wants to grow. Everything wants to get bigger.
We're builders, human beings, we're builders.
Yeah. Every economy, you know, growth is what we want. But we can't do this indefinitely. We're on a finite space, finite resources. We have to somehow limit our numbers one day. We cannot just keep on growing. But it is an urge we cannot seem to resist.
Michael Beard is self-indulgent, self-destructive. Are you an optimist or a pessimist on this topic?
I swing wildly on this. Sometimes it just depends what I read last, almost. But I retain a vein of optimism that our cleverness will trump our stupidity in this, and that we'll come through. And that I think it won't be governments that deliver this from us.
There's a recent poll I read. It's a Gallup poll, and it's very interesting. And it says that Americans' attitudes towards environmental concerns are lower in terms of these issues as real issues or as a priority. Their skepticism of global climate change and of the scientists behind it is higher as a package than we've seen in a long time. This basket of environmental issues being held in lower priority than we've seen in 20 years.
I know. I think the whole process has taken a huge downward turn. There's been the UEA emails, there's been the misreporting of the ice melt in the Tibetan plateau, and there's been Copenhagen, which I think has had a hugely depressing effect on people in this. Part of this problem, I think, is that people think that scientists are somehow godly and above the fray. So that when they're exposed as being, you know, hostile to each other or ego-driven, people are surprised or astounded. But in fact, any lab is full of the same jealousies and egomania as any other human organization, and science is frail and messy and advances by fits and starts and sometimes takes a couple of paces backwards. And the other thing is that climate science itself is young. The biosphere and the Earth's climate is an incredibly complex system. We're bound to make errors. My challenge really to the deniers in this, because I think they've been making a lot of running, is to get out there and do some empirical research. Don't sit on the edges waiting for one scientist to make a mistake, but get out there and collect some satellite data that you seem to have a lot of money and put it up for peer review. Let us judge it, and we'll crack out the champagne if the Earth is not warming. We'll be delighted.
I'm Frank Sesno, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're talking with Ian McEwan, author, most recently, of the book Solar. If you'd like to join us and speak with Ian McEwan, ask a question, please dial 1-800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. We'll go to the phones in just a minute. This book was released in the midst of these challenges to climate change, in the midst of this scientific flap. Not intentional. I'm sure you started this well before all of that. What is the relevance, you hope, of this book to the larger discussion?
Well, I hope that people will accept that scientists are as human as the rest of us.
You've certainly given them a very human example in Michael Beard.
I mean, it was famously said once that science proceeds by funerals. You have to wait for one scientist to die and a younger scientist to come along. In other words, the project of science is always greater than the practitioners. And I hope it will reflect something of this rather unique dilemma we have, in which our nature is, you know, sorely tested.
Ian McEwan, if you put on your headphones, I'm going to, so that you can hear our callers, I'm going to go to our first caller and let Nathan, who's calling in from Fort Lauderdale, Florida, lead us off. Hi, Nathan. Thanks for calling.
You're welcome. Thank you, Frank. I was wondering whether you superficially or unconsciously based the character of Frank Beard on Albert Gore, because there are three similarities. He's about 65 pounds overweight. He overconsumes, as based on the Tennessee Policy Institute's assessment of his mansion, and he also has a Nobel Prize.
Thanks, Nathan. Two corrections if before, Ian, you answer the question. One, it's Mike Beard, Michael Beard, not Frank. I don't want to have any...
Yeah, you're Frank.
Yes, Michael. Please.
Let's not confuse you.
I do not want to be identified with your character here. And secondly, actually, I saw Al Gore at an event not too long ago. He's dropped a lot of weight. So now you may tell us whether, because he had put it on,
yes,
whether there's any connection between your character, Michael Beard,
well,
our former vice president, Al Gore.
It's a very entertaining thought, and I can put my hand on my heart and tell you it had not crossed my mind. But still, now you've put that little seed there, who knows, it'll probably start to grow a tree. But no, I had not thought of anyone at all. I dread some fat physicist getting in touch with my lawyers. The only hope really is that 40 such physicists will all rise up at once and cancel each other out.
To the phones. And Ray from Merritt Island, Florida. Hi, Ray.
How you doing?
Very well. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, my question for the author is this, and he alluded to it in the comment he made previously, is one of the things these environmental conferences don't address is the number of people on the planet, because scientists, no matter how hard they work, won't produce the silver bullet to come against the growing numbers of people on the Earth, and the conferences never seem to address this as an extremely important issue in controlling the climate and a lot of other things on our planet.
I think it's a very, very good point indeed. Back in the 70s, it was a very central concern. If you look at the books and the graphs that were published then, we would have maybe about 4 billion people more than was then thought. It is very difficult to legislate against people having more than two children, or it's very hard to do anything about this. I mean, the Chinese with their one child policy has led to some terrible instances of female babies, girls being disposed of in peasant societies and so on. The best hope, I think, is the education of women and rising well-being in developing countries. Because what you find is that once income gets above a certain level, maybe $2,000 or $3,000 or $4,000 a year, and people get a little more control of their lives, they will begin to have smaller families. So it's intricately tied up with poverty and development.
We're talking with Ian McEwan, author of Atonement. More of your calls and more of the Diane Rehm Show coming up in just a moment after this short break. I'm Frank Sesno. Stay with us. We'll continue our discussion.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing. ConstantContact.com. By the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at WTGrantFoundation.org. And by MetLife Foundation, proudly supporting NPR's coverage of aging, on the web at metlife.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, King of the Swing Fiddle, Johnny Gimble. At the age of 83, he's still swinging and playing. He joins up with Vince Gill, Merle Haggard, Willie Nelson, and others on his new CD, Celebrating with Friends. Join us.
You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. I'm Frank Sesno, sitting in for Diane today. Our guest is Ian McEwan, author of Solar. And we are having a fascinating conversation about the scoundrel character in your book. His name is Michael Beard. He is a Nobel Prize winner. He is a physicist. He's been married, what, five times?
Five times.
He keeps putting on weight. He keeps doing bad things. And yet he's got this idea, with his stolen idea about these wonderful photovoltaics, maybe he can save the planet and get a little rich in the process. Ian McEwan, we have an interesting email from Mike, and I'd like to read this to you and get your response because it tracks with what you're saying and what your book is charting a bit here. I think the main problem, Mike writes, with the public's skepticism on global warming and environmental issues is that we are, as a society, are more and more divorced from the natural world and more reliant on man-made things for their feeling of contentment. The overall ignorance and indifference of the public about the most elementary effects of climate change on the natural world is astounding, he writes.
No, it's well put. I'm a passionate hiker. I spend a lot of time walking mountain ridges and across deserts, and whenever I'm doing it, I feel, where is everyone else? But it's a great luxury to be maybe only 20 miles from a major city and there's no one else around. Everybody else, or nearly everybody else, and thank goodness to some extent, seems to be happy on the pavement or in the park or in the office. The tragedy, though, is we cannot get back to nature en masse. There are too many of us. And the difficult fact to take on board is the most energy-efficient way to live is in a city. If we all took out to the suburbs or the ex-suburbias or all wanted a few acres of beautiful wilderness, we would consume vastly more energy than when we're in mass transportation systems or all eating in a diner or sharing the heat energy in a large apartment block. So maybe it's to do with our education, but it's a very good point. I think that many people think that the climate's really got nothing to do with them except insofar as whether it's raining or not, and they should get a coat and an umbrella, and that they don't feel part of the great order of things, and that we're not biological animals, and we don't actually have our dependencies all the way down the food chain to microbes. So it's well put.
To the phones, and Carol, who's calling in from New Hampshire. Hi, Carol. Go ahead with your question for Ian McEwen.
Yes. I follow the science of climate change very closely and have been doing so for the last 30 years. And despite all of the evidence to the contrary, I have continued to be an optimist that technologically we could do something to turn this around. And I guess I'm still remain this way, but I would like to know if you have picked up on the latest scientific reports that are coming out about the melting of the permafrost all around the top of the northern hemisphere, and along with that, the emissions of methane that appear to be accelerating. And with that happening, and because methane is four times more powerful greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide is, it seems to me that we've already gone past a very important tipping point. And so given that situation, are you still remaining optimistic that we can do something? I am, because I guess it's just part of my constitution.
Okay, Carol, let's let Ian respond to that. A lot in that question.
Well, it's a very serious matter, the methane releases from the permafrost. There's also worry about hydrogen clathrates in the ocean. Whether this will constitute a tipping point or not, I think is still up for discussion and examination. If one concentrates too much on that, I think the optimism does come under heavy pressure here. But if you go and speak to people, say, out on just south of Stanford, you run into an unbelievable sort of heady mix of can-do environmental scientists, of financiers, venture capitalists, and they are brimming with ideas and technologies. New batteries way beyond the lithium-ion ones that will use atmospheric oxygen as part of their catalyst. Artificial photosynthesis itself could one day scale up out of the lab to bring us free hydrogen. So we do have it within our power, even with existing technologies of wind and solar and tidal and wave and so on. But we've got to be moving quickly.
You think we should? You didn't mention nuclear power there. Should that be a big part of the mix? Because you can light whole cities up with nuclear power plants. In this country, we haven't built a plant in more than 30 years.
I have to say, Frank, when I was against nuclear till I spent 3 years reading the climate science, and I think that we are going to have to embrace it.
So you flipped on nuclear power?
I have flipped entirely. I think that it's crucial to get us through the next 30 or 40 years to have this technology. It's pretty tried and tested now. France has been running virtually all of its energy needs on nuclear. These are no longer Three Mile Island or Chernobyl-type machines. They and also there's a lot of research being done in nuclear power that would not give us such radioactive waste, using thorium, for example. And there's a plant up and running in South Africa that is rather successful. We have the technologies already to deal with this. What we require now is the collective will. And at the moment, we're stumbling.
There's an email here from Pat, who is on the other side of this, some of the science discussion that we've been having, and wants to know more. Please ask your guest his thoughts on the recent revelations of data manipulation and exaggeration surrounding the ClimateGate scandal. I don't mean to suggest that Pat is anti-science. I don't have no idea where Pat is on the subject of the science,
right.
But in terms of wondering where you are and what your thoughts are on these scientists who had exaggerated emails and suppressed or tried to suppress some of the information and data.
Yes, this is UEA. It's my old university. It's the home of the John Tyndall Centre. John Tyndall was the Irish Victorian scientist who first identified greenhouse gases. Not sufficiently honoured, in my view. First one to tell us why the sky is blue. This was a vast database of emails, and in it we find some scientists a little jealous of each other. One wanted a paper that was against his own conclusions excluded from an IPCC report, and poor behaviour, tried to get his colleagues to make sure this paper was not published. Well, the fact is, it was published in the IPCC report. He was not successful. The other discussion that's been much made of was about tree ring data. There was 1,000 years missing and of recent tree ring data, and he did what many scientists do. He extrapolated. He called it a trick, but it was an extrapolation. Much has been made of that. But I just repeat, scientists are human. Labs are full of egos, and I think that the mileage made out of this is out of all proportion.
We'll go to the phones, and Katie joins us from Greensboro, North Carolina, with a question, I think, about how you work as an author. Hi, Katie.
Good morning, Mr. Sesno. Good morning, Mr. McEwen. Thank you for taking my question.
Thanks for joining us.
As a past English teacher and a future librarian, I'm really interested to hear how your writing process in this book differed from, if at all, from some of your past writings. Did you spend more time on research? Did you have a structured writing schedule? How did you approach this novel?
Well, I'm pretty chaotic in my work schedules. It doesn't really follow a fixed pattern from book to book. In this case, I did a fair amount of reading while I was writing, but then now and then I just leave the writing behind and go on the road. For example, I set off across New Mexico looking for a technology that Michael Beard might put under his belt, and visited this rather lovely but somewhat neglected lab in Golden, Colorado, the NREL. This novel ends in the little town of Lordsburg in the boot heel of New Mexico. It took me a long time to find Lordsburg. I wanted a little town. I tried out many others. So the research often directs the shape of the writing, even as I'm writing the book.
And did you have a full picture of Michael Beard in your head before you started writing? Did he develop as you? Did you start out saying, "Okay, I'm going to make him fatter and fatter as we go"? And
no, one thing leads to another. He's eating a meal. Then I think, well, you know, what's his fate? Novels are sort of like journeys. You know, they are processes of investigation. And so one thing will often generate another. A book that's too planned ahead, I always think, will not deliver the surprises that make a working morning so pleasurable.
Do you write in long stretches at a time?
Yes, I'm pretty compulsive. I like to work in the morning. Even when I'm stuck, and I do get stuck a lot, I still think it's crucial to turn up.
Do you get up at 2 in the morning and start writing?
No, I like a good night's sleep.
And you go for a walk first? Do you have a routine?
No routines, but I love to walk. And I have a place in the country where I work. I'm surrounded by beech woods, so I go for long, moody walks in the beech woods. But turning up at the desk, even when you think you're not going to get much done, is the most crucial thing.
Do you ever have writer's block?
Yes. I don't
even
call it,
you have writer's
block? I don't call it writer's block. I call it hesitation. It's crucial sometimes to pause. And what happens is that often there are 10 options in front of you, and I don't know which one to take. Well, time will solve it. If you just pause, just hesitate, leave it a week, there's no great rush. Who in the universe is going to care whether I write 20 novels or 19 at the end of my life? You know, I always tell myself that.
Do you ever look down and a day's worth of writing or an hour's worth of writing, I just hate that?
Yes.
And you just hit delete?
No.
Never.
Don't hit delete. Put it in a separate file. There might be something in there that you'll need.
A nugget.
Yes.
The next book.
Maybe, or just, you know, it can be resuscitated.
You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. I'm Frank Sesno, sitting in for Diane today. Our guest is Ian McEwan, author of Solar. And if you'd like to join us in our final few minutes, our number is 1-800-433-8850. Or you can send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Another reading, if you would.
Sure.
This one that I'd like to ask you about, it sort of, in a sense, doesn't complete the picture of your character, Michael Beard, and perhaps the human race, but it's arresting because at this moment he's had a child he didn't want, with a woman who surprised him with this pregnancy, and confronting his legacy, his own future, has some surprising thoughts.
The surprise was this. His existence since Katrina's birth was much as before. His friends had told him he would be astonished, he would be transformed, his values would change. But nothing was transformed. Katrina was fine, but it was the same old mess. And now that he had entered upon the final active stages of his life, he was beginning to understand that, barring accidents, life did not change. He had been deluded. He had always assumed that a time would come in adulthood, a kind of plateau, when he would have learned all the tricks of managing, of simply being. All mails and emails answered, all papers in order, books alphabetically on the shelves, clothes and shoes in good repair in the wardrobes, and all his stuff where he could find it, with the past, including its letters and photographs, sorted into boxes and files, the private life settled and serene, accommodation and finances likewise. In all these years, this settlement, the calm plateau, had never appeared. And yet he had continued to assume, without reflecting on the matter, that it was just around the next turn, when he would exert himself and reach it, that moment when his life became clear and his mind free, when his grown-up existence could properly begin. But not long after Katrina's birth, about the time he met Darlene, he thought he saw for the first time. On the day he died, he would be wearing unmatching socks. There would be unanswered emails. And in the hovel he called home, there would still be shirts missing cuff buttons, a malfunctioning light in the hall, and unpaid bills, uncleared attics, dead flies, friends waiting for a reply, and lovers he had not owned up to. Oblivion, the last word in organization, would be his only consolation.
Oblivion. Oblivion. One of the critiques I've read of this book and some of the reviews is that we are forced to live in Michael Beard's very claustrophobic, self-absorbed world, and that becomes claustrophobic for the reader. Your response?
I don't think Michael Beard is claustrophobic at all because he's a scientist and his mind does move out in many directions. Some people don't like traveling with him just because he's not a nice guy, and people like their heroes of novels to be good people. Well, I tend to take the view that that's a sort of kitsch, and actually no one is particularly thoroughly always good. We all have our faults, and I'm pleased that there are other readers who just love being with Michael Beard. They just sort of like the freedom of his scoundrel nature.
You've had scoundrel characters in the past. Certainly Atonement was an uncomfortable situation where our adolescent girl sets in train a series of events and lives that are awkward. It became a major motion picture. Will Solar and Michael Beard become a major motion picture?
Well, the rights have been sold, which doesn't tell you much, I guess, at this stage.
Who would you cast as Michael Beard?
That's a really good question, isn't it? Well, maybe Al Gore is free.
Oh, gosh. All right, well, we just might leave it at that. Ian McEwan, thank you very much. The book is Solar, and Michael Beard is a a challenging character. The topic is a challenging topic, the topic of climate change and science. But thank you very much for being with us today and for making this contribution to the discussion.
It's been a real pleasure.
Good luck and safe travels and happy hiking, because you're doing some hiking, as I understand.
That's right. Off to the desert.
Off to the desert, and good thinking. You've been listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Our guest today has indeed been Ian McEwan, author of Solar. I'm Frank Sesno, sitting in for Diane. She'll be back tomorrow. Have a very pleasant day, and I'll talk to you soon.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.